Chapter 11. Circumterran Orbit, 14-4-54. Three of them waited within the spacecraft. Lindsay, Vera Constantine, and their lobster navigator, who was known simply as Pilot.
"Final approach," Pilot said. His beautiful synthesized voice emerged from a vocoder unit hooked to his throat.
Strapped in before his control board, the lobster was a chunk of shadow. He was sealed within a matte black permanent spacesuit, knobbed with lumps of internal machinery, and dotted with shiny gold input jacks. Lobsters were creatures of the vacuum, faceless posthumans, their eyes and ears wired to sensors woven through the suits. Pilot never ate, never drank. The routines of his body were subsumed within the life-supporting rhythms of his suit. Pilot did not like being within this spacecraft. Lobsters had a horror of enclosed spaces. Pilot, though, had put up with the discomfort for the thrill of the crime. Now that they were dropping from orbit, the drugged calm of weeks of travel had broken. Lindsay had never seen Vera so animated. Her open delight filled him with pleasure. And she had reason for gladness. The presence was gone. She had not felt it since the three of them had been sealed within the spacecraft. They'd come so far since then, and she believed she had escaped it for good. She found as much happiness in this relief as in the fulfillment of their long conspiracy. Lindsay was happy for her. He had never had true proof of the objective existence of the presence, but he had agreed to believe in it for her. And similarly, she had never doubted him. It was a contract and a trust between them. He knew she might have killed him, but that trust had saved his life. Long years since then had only strengthened it.
"Looks good," the lobster sang.
The spacecraft began to buck as it hit the entrance window of the Earth's atmosphere. The lobster emitted a burst of static, then said,
"Air. I hate air. I hate it already."
"Steady," Lindsay said.
He tightened the straps of his chair and unfolded his video screens. They were coming in over the continent once known as Africa. Its outlines had been radically changed by the rising seas. Archipelagos of drowned hills trailed clouds above a soup of weed-choked ocean. Along the dark shore, rivers poured gray topsoil into water streaked red with algal blooms. The white-hot flare of entry heat obscured his vision, flickering over the diamond-hard hull lens of the forward scanner. Lindsay leaned back in his seat. It was an odd ship, an uncomfortable one, not of human manufacture. The egg-shaped hull had the off-white sheen of stabilized metallic hydrogen, built only by gas bags. Its naked interior floor and ceiling bore the round, scalloped segmentation marks of its former pilot, a gas bag grub. The spacefaring grub had been packed within the hull as tightly as expanding dough. One of the gas bags had alluded to the astronaut's death in a conversation with Vera Constantine. With its keen sensitivity to magnetic flux, the unlucky grub had perceived a solar flare whose shape and substance it found somehow blasphemous. It had expired in despair. Lindsay had been looking for just such a chance. When Vera told him of the accident, Lindsay acted at once. He recruited the lobsters through their business contact in Serena Cluster, a lobster they called the Modem. A complex deal was worked out in utter secrecy with the anarchic lobsters. One of their lacy, airless spacecraft used Vera's coordinates to track down the dead grub. Lindsay allowed them to dissect it and appropriate its alien engines. In return, they outfitted the emptied shell for a furtive attempt to break the interdict with Earth. The interdict had never applied to the gas bags. They had insisted on exploring the entire solar system and had granted equal rights to the pioneers in Fomalhaut. Their surveying craft had often studied the Earth. They made no attempt to contact the local primitives. They had satisfied themselves that the planet was harmless and had returned in utter disinterest. With his two companions, Lindsay had assumed his ultimate disguise. He was passing himself off as an alien in an attempt to deceive the entire Schismatrix. Excitement and triumph had stripped decades from Lindsay.
He had turned up his chest cuirass so that his heart could labor in time with his feelings. The forearm monitor embedded in his arm glowed amber with adrenaline. The spacecraft skipped above the bloated South Atlantic and sank deep within the atmosphere at the twilight line. Deceleration pressed Lindsay into the straps of his skeletal chair. The lobster had done a quick, primitive job. The three-man crew was crammed into a ribbed lozenge 4 meters across. It held 2 airframes, a recycler, and 3 acceleration couches of black elastic webbing over iron frames epoxied to the floor. The rest of the craft was taken up by engines and a garage-like specimen hold. In the hold crouched a surveyor robot, one of the European submarine probes. The dead astronaut's former orifices had been stripped of tissue and outfitted with cameras and scanning systems. The specimen hold had a hatchway installed, but there was no room for an airlock in the crew's compartment. The 3 of them had been welded in. Pilot hadn't liked it. Pilot could be trusted, though. He cared nothing for Europa or their plans, but he relished the chance to count coup on the ancestral gravity well. He had been everywhere, from the turbulent fringes of the solar corona to the cometary Oort cloud at the edge of circumsolar space. He was not human, but for the time being, he was one of them. The scanners began to clear. Deceleration faded into the heavy tug of Earth gravity. Lindsay slumped in his chair, wheezing as the cuirass pumped his lungs.
"Look what this muck is doing to the stars," Pilot complained melodiously.
Vera reached beside her chair and unfolded her tight-packed accordioned screens. She straightened the video board with a pop and smoothed out the creases.
"Look, Abelard, there's so much air above us that it's blurring the stars. Think how much air. It's fantastic."
Lindsay stirred himself and examined the view from the aft camera. Behind them, a wall of thunderheads towered to the limits of the troposphere. Black roots, furred with rain, rose to white anvil heads, glowing in the last of the twilight. This was one outstretched arm of the storm zone of permanent tempests that girdled the planet's equator. He expanded the aft view to fill the whole video board. What he saw awed him.
"Look aft at the storm clouds," he said. "Huge streaks of fire are leaping out of them. What could be burning?"
"Chunks of vegetation?" Vera said.
"Wait, no, it's lightning," Lindsay said. "As in the old phrase, thunder and lightning."
He stared in utter fascination.
"Lightning bolts are supposed to be red, with jagged edges," Vera said. "These are like thin white branches."
"The disaster must have changed their form," Lindsay said.
The storm vanished over the horizon.
"Coastline coming up," Pilot said.
Sunset fell. They switched to infrareds.
"This is part of America," Lindsay concluded. "It was called Mexico, or possibly Texaco. The coastline looked different before the ice caps melted. I don't recognize any of this."
Pilot struggled with the controls.
Vera said, "We're going faster than the movement of sound in this atmosphere. Slow down, Pilot."
"Muck," Pilot complained. "Do you really want to see this? What if the locals see us?"
"They're primitives. They don't have infrareds," Vera said.
"You mean they use only the visible spectrum?"
Now Pilot himself was stunned. They studied the landscape below, knots of dense scrubland shining in the false black and white of infrared. The wilderness was striped occasionally by half-obscured dark streaks.
"Tectonic faults?" Vera said.
"Roads," Lindsay said.
He explained about low-friction surfaces for ground travel in gravity. They had not seen any cities as yet, though there had been suggestive patches here and there, where the rioting vegetation seemed thinner. Pilot took them lower. They pored over the growth at high magnification.
"Weeds," Lindsay concluded. "Since the disaster, all ecological stability has collapsed. Adventitious species have moved in. This was probably all cropland once."
"It's ugly," Vera said.
"Systems in collapse often are."
"High energy flux ahead,"
Pilot said. The spacecraft dipped and hovered over a ridge. Wildfire swept the hillside, whole kilometers of orange glow in the darkness. Roaring updrafts flung up flakes of growing ash, reverse cascades of stripped-off leaves and branches. Behind the wall of fire were the twisted, glowing skeletons of weeds grown large as trees, their smoldering trunks thick bundles of woody filament. They said nothing, stirred to the core by the wonder of it.
Sundog plants, Lindsay said at last.
What?
The weeds are like sundogs. They thrive on disaster. They move in anywhere where systems break down. After this disaster, the plants that grow fastest on scorched earth will thrive.
More weeds, Vera concluded.
Yes.
They left the fire behind and cruised past the foothills. Lindsay tapped one of the algae frames and ate a mouthful of green paste.
Aircraft, Pilot said.
For a moment, Lindsay thought he was seeing a mutant gas bag, some bizarre example of parallel evolution. Then he realized it was a flying machine, some kind of blimp or zeppelin. Long seamed ridges of sewn balloon skin supported a skeletal gondola. A thin skein of flexible solar-powered discs dotted the craft's skin, dappling over its back, fading to a white underbelly. Long mooring lines trailed from its nose, like drooping antennae. They approached cautiously and saw its mooring ground, a city. A gridwork of streets split a checkerboard of white stone shelters. The houses were marshaled around a looming central core, a four-sided masonry pyramid. The zeppelin was moored to the pyramid's apex. The whole city was hemmed in by a high rectangular wall. Outside, agriculture fields glowed a ghastly white, manured with ashes. A ceremony was progressing, a pyre blazing at the masonry plaza at the pyramid's foot. The city's population was drawn up in ranks. They numbered less than 2,000. Their clothing was bleached by the infrared glow of their body heat.
What is it? Said Vera. Why don't they move?
A funeral, I think, Lindsay said.
What's the pyramid, then? A mausoleum? An indoctrination center?
Both, maybe. Do you see the cable system? The mausoleum has an information line, the only one in the village. Whoever lives there holds all links to the outside world.
Lindsay thought suddenly of the domed stronghold of the Nephrine Black Medicals in the circumlunar Zaibatsu. He hadn't thought of it for years, but he remembered the psychic atmosphere within it, the sense of paranoid isolation, of fanaticism slowly drifting past the limits through lack of variety, a world gone stale.
Stability, he said. The Terrans wanted stability. That's why they set up the interdict. They didn't want technology to break them into pieces, as it's done to us. They blamed technology for the disasters. The war plagues, the carbon dioxide that melted the ice caps. They can't forget they're dead.
Surely the whole world isn't like this, Vera said.
It has to be. Anywhere there is variety, there is the risk of change. Change that can't be tolerated.
But they have telephones, aircraft.
Enforcement technology, Lindsay said.
On their way to the Pacific, they saw two more settlements separated by miles of festering wilderness. The cities were as identical as circuit chips. They crouched unnaturally on the landscape. They could have been stamped out from some hydraulic press and dropped from the air. Pilot pointed out more of the bloated aircraft. Their full significance became clear to Lindsay. The flying machines were like plague vectors, carrying the ideological virus of some calcifying cultural disease. The pyramids towered in the heart of every city, enormous, dwarfing all hope, the strangling monuments of the legions of the dead. Tears came to him. He wept quietly, holding nothing back. He mourned mankind and the blindness of men, who thought that the cosmos had rules and limits that would shelter them from their own freedom. There were no shelters. There were no final purposes. Futility and freedom were absolute. They slipped beneath the ocean south of the rocky island chain of Baja California. Pilot opened the hatchway, flooding the cargo hold with water, and they began at once to sink. They were in search of the world's largest single ecosystem, the only biome man never touched. The surface waters had not escaped. Over the drowned lands of the continental margins, rafts of rotting moss and algae, the ocean's equivalents of weeds, festered in choking profusion. But the abyssal depths were undisturbed. In the crushing blackness of the abyss, larger in area than all the continents combined, conditions scarcely varied from pole to pole. The denizens of this vast realm were poorly known. No human being had ever invented a way to wring advantage from them. But in the Schismatrix, man's successors were more clever. The resemblance of this realm to the dark oceans of Europa had not escaped Lindsay. For decades, he had searched the ancient databanks for scraps of knowledge. The surviving records of abyssal life were almost useless, dating back to the dawn of biology. But even these crude hints lured Lindsay with their potential for sudden miracle. Europa, too, had the gloominess, the depths, and the vast drowned ranges of volcanic rifts oozing geothermal energy. The abyss had oases. It had always had them. The knowledge had lit a slow subterranean fire in his imagination. Life, untouched primeval life, swarmed in boiling splendor at the fiery edges of the Earth's tectonic plates. An entire ecosystem, older than mankind, clustered there in all its miraculous richness. Life that could be seized, that could be Europa's. At first he had rejected the idea. The interdict was sacred, as old as the unspoken guilt of ancestral spacefarers, who had deserted Earth as disaster loomed. In their desertion, they had robbed the planet of the very expertise that might have saved it. Over centuries of life in space, that guilt had sunk into a darkened region of cultural awareness, surfacing only as caricature, as a ritual denial and deliberate ignorance. The parting had come with hatred, with those in space condemned as anti-human thieves, the Earth's emergency government denounced as fascist barbarism. Hatred made things easier for those in space to shrug off all responsibility, easier for Earth to starve its myriad cultures down to a single gray regime of penance and pointless stability. But life moved in clades. Lindsay knew it as a fact. A successful species always burst into a joyous wave of daughter species, of hopeful monsters that rendered their ancestors obsolete. Denying change meant denying life. By this token, he knew that humanity on Earth had become a relict. In the long term, the vast biological timescape that had become Lindsay's obsession, rust ate anything that failed to move. Earth's future did not belong to humanity, but to the monstrous weeds, grown strange and woody, and whatever small fleet creatures leaped and bred among them. And Lindsay felt justice in it. They sank into darkness. Pressure meant nothing to their alien hull. The gas bags flourished at extremes of pressure that made Earth's oceans seem as thin as plasma. Pilots switched controls over to the water jets epoxied to the hull. He kicked in aperture radar, and their video boards lit up with the clean green contour lines of the abyssal floor. Lindsay's heart leaped as he saw the familiar geology.
"Just like Europa," Vera murmured.
They were floating over an extended tension fault, where volcanic basalt had snapped and rifted, harsh blocks jutting upward, the cracked primeval violence untouched by wind or rain. Rectilinear mountains, lightly dusted with organic ooze, dropped in breathtaking precipitous cliffs, where contour lines crowded together like the teeth of a comb. But here, the rift was dead. They saw no sign of thermal energy. "Follow the fault," Lindsay said. "Look for hot spots." He had lived too long for impatience, even now.
"Shall I kick in the main engines?" Pilot said.
"And make the water boil for miles around? We're deep, Pilot. That water is like steel."
"Is it?"
Pilot made an electronic churring noise.
"Well, I'd rather have no stars at all than blurry ones."
They followed the rifts for hours without finding a lava seep. Vera slept. Lindsay dozed briefly, an old man's cat sleep. Pilot, who slept only on formal occasions, woke them.
A hot spot, he said.
Lindsay examined his board. Infrareds showed sluggish heat from deep within the interior of a jutting cliff. The cliff was extremely odd, a long, tilted plain of Euclidean smoothness rising abruptly from an oozy badlands of jumbled terrain. An angular foothill at the base of the cliff lay strangely distorted, almost crumpled, atop a dome-shaped rise of lava.
"Send out the drone," he said.
Vera pulled the robot's controls from under her seat and slipped on a pair of iPhones. The robot sculled easily out to the anomalous cliff, its lights blazing. Lindsay switched his board over to the robot's optics. The tilted cliff was painted. There were white stripes on it, long peeling dashes, some kind of dividing line.
"It's a wreck," he said suddenly. "It's man-made."
"Can't be," she said. "It's the size of a major spacecraft. There'd be room in it for thousands."
But then she found something that settled it. A machine was lashed to the smooth cliff-like deck of the enormous ship. Centuries had corroded it, but its winged outlines were clear.
"It's an aircraft," Pilot said. "It had jets. This was some kind of watery spaceport. Airport, rather."
"A ratfish," Lindsay exulted. "After it, Vera."
The surveyor lunged after the abyssal creature. The long-tailed, blunt-headed fish, the size of a man's forearm, darted for safety along the broad deck of the aircraft carrier. It vanished through the ruptured crevice in the multi-story wreckage of the control tower. The robot pulled up short.
"Wait," Vera said. "If this is a ship, where did the heat come from?"
Pilot examined his instruments.
"It's radioactive heat," he said. "Is that unusual?"
"Fission power," Lindsay said. "It must have sunk with an atomic pile on board."
Common decency forbade him to mention the possibility of atomic weapons. Vera said,
"My instruments show dissolved organics. Creatures are huddled up around the pile for warmth."
She tore at an ancient bulkhead with the pressure-toughened arms of the drone. The corroded alloy burst easily, gushing rust.
"Should I go after it?"
"No," Lindsay said. "I want the primeval."
She returned the drone to its hold. They sputtered onward. Time passed. Terrain scrolled by with a slowness he would have once found dreadful. Lindsay found himself thinking again of Tsarina Cluster. Sometimes it troubled him that the despair, the suffering there, meant so little to him. CK was dying, its elegance dissolving into squalor, its delicate, sophisticated balance ripped apart, pieces flung like seeds throughout the schismatrics. Was it evil of him to accept the flower's death, in hope of seeds? He could not think it was. Human time meant nothing to him any longer. He wanted only for his will to leave its mark, to cast its light down those long eons in a world awakened, a planet brought to irrevocable life. And then he could let go.
"Here,"
Pilot said. They had found it. The craft descended. Life rose all around them, a jungle in defiance of the sun. In the robot's lights, the steep, abrasive valley walls flushed in a vivid panoply of color. Scarlet, chalk white, sulfur gold, obsidian. Like stands of bamboo, tube worms swayed on the hillsides, taller than a man. The rocks were thick with clams, their white shells yawning to show flesh as red as blood. Purple sponges pulsed. Abyssal corals spread black, branching thickets, their thin arms jeweled with polyps. The water of life gushed from the depths of the valley. Chimneys slimed with metal oxides spewed hot clouds of energized sulfur. The seafloor boiled, wobbling bubbles of steam glinting through a haze of bacteria. The bacteria were central. They were the food chain's fundamental link. Through chemosynthesis, they drew energy from the sulfur itself, scorning the sun to thrive on the heat of the earth. Within the warmth and darkness, the valley seethed with life. The rock itself seemed to live, festooned with porous knobs and slimed crevices, red-black tubes of cold lava stone coiled like snakes, phallic chimneys of precipitated minerals gleaming copper-green with verdigris, pale crabs with legs as long as a man's arm kicked daintily across the slopes, jet-black abyssal fish, grown fat on unexpected bounty, moved with slick languor through the clustered stalks of the tube worms. Bright yellow jellies, like severed flower heads, floated in thick eddies of bacterial soup.
"Everything," Lindsay breathed. "I want it all."
Vera pulled away her iPhones. Her eyes were flooded with tears. She slumped back in the seat, shaking.
"I can't see," she said, her voice hoarse.
She handed him the control box.
"Please, it should be yours, Abelard."
Lindsay strapped on the phones, slipped his fingers into the control slots. Suddenly, he was amid it all, the scanners turning with the movements of his head. He extended the sampling arms, extruding the delicate clockwork of the genetics needles. He advanced on the nearest stand of tube worms. Above the serried white columns of their wrist-thick trunks, their foliage was rank upon waving rank of arm-long feathered red fronds, sweeping with feminine elegance, combing life from the water. Their white stems clustered with sheltered creatures, barnacles, tiny crabs, fringed worms in sea green and electric blue, round comb jellies glinting in faint pastels. A predator emerged from the jungle, flowing sinuously around the trunks, a jet-black abyssal fish, leg-sized and flattened like an eel, its sides studded with serried dots of phosphorescence. It approached fearlessly, fascinated by the light. Gills pulsed behind its huge-eyed head, and it opened a pale, glowing mouth bristling with fangs.
"So," Lindsay addressed it, "you were pressed past the limits, forced into the abyss where nothing grows. But see what you found? The fat of the system, sun dog. Welcome to paradise."
As he spoke, he moved the arm toward it. The long needle leaped out, touched it, and withdrew. The fish glowed out in sudden gold and green and flashed away. He moved to the forest, touching everything he could see, sampling bacteria with gentle suction filters. In half an hour, he had filled all his sample capsules and turned back to the ship for more. Then he saw something detach itself from the hull of the ship. At first he thought it a trick of the light, a ripple of pure reflection. Then he saw it moving toward him, wobbling, fluttering, shapeless, formless, a jellied mirror, fluid in a silver bag. He heard Vera cry out. He wrenched his hands from the controls and tore away the iPhones. She was bent over the video board, staring.
"The presence! You see it? The presence!"
It was swimming, with an amoeba-like rippling and stretching, deeper into the grove. Lindsay quickly jammed on the iPhones and took up the controls, following it with the robot's light. Its formless surface threw washes of reflected brilliance over the clams and coral. Lindsay said,
"You see it, pilot?"
Pilot turned the spacecraft to follow it with tracking systems.
"I see something. It reflects in every wavelength. What a strange creature. Take a sample of it, Lindsay."
"It's not native. It came with us. I saw it attached to the hull."
"To the hull? It survived raw space and entry heat and the pressure of this water? It can't be."
"No?"
"No," the lobster said. "Because if it was real, I couldn't bear not to be it."
"It's showing itself," Vera exulted.
"Because of where we are. You see? You see?" She laughed. "It's dancing."
The thing floated smoothly above one of the smoking chimneys, flattening itself to bathe in the searing updraft of unthinkable pressure and heat. Hot bubbles seethed beneath it, sliding with frictionless ease off its mirrored undersurface. As they watched, it drew itself together into a rippling globe. Then, liquescing with sudden speed, it poured itself through a thumb-sized crevice into the core of the heat vent. It vanished at once.
I didn't see that, the lobster insisted. I didn't see it vanish into the bowels of the earth. Should we leave now? I mean, maybe we should try to get away from it.
No, Vera said.
You're right, Pilot quavered. That might make it mad.
Vera marveled.
Did you see it? It was enjoying this. Even it knows. It knows this is paradise.
She was trembling.
Abelard, someday in Europa, this will all be ours. We can touch it, feel it, breathe the water, smell it, taste it. I want it. I want to be out there like the presence is.
She was breathing hard, her face radiant.
Abelard, if it weren't for you, I'd have never known this. Thank you. Thank you too, Pilot.
Rightly, yes, surely, Pilot fluted uneasily. Lindsay, the drone, should you bring it in?
Lindsay smiled. Don't be afraid, Pilot. It's done you a favor. You've seen the potential. Now you'll have something to aim for.
But think of the power it must have. It's like a god.
Then it's in good company with us.
Lindsay guided the drone into the specimen hold and unloaded the genetic capsules into their pressure racks. He reloaded its arms and returned to work. The presence emerged, ballooning suddenly from a second chimney beside the drone. It drifted toward him, watching. He waved a claw, but it made no response and soon drifted out of the drone's light into darkness and invisibility. The creatures showed no fear of the drone. Vera took over, gently parting the supple stems of the tube worms to harvest everything she could find. The drone walked the length of the valley oasis, probing the ooze, prying into crevices. They had a stroke of luck where a new hot spring had broken open, parboiling a colony of creatures clustered above it on an overhang. They used the dead as bait to attract scavengers. They opened them to sample gut bacteria and the agents of decay. Their sample could not be complete. The oasis was far too rich for that. But their success was still entire. No creature born to the seas of Earth could live unaltered in Europa's alien waters. That was the task of Europa's angels, the Lifesiders, who would inherit its genetic treasure, tease it apart, and rebuild new creatures for the new conditions. The living beings here would be models, archetypes in a new creation, where art and purpose would take the place of a billion years of evolution. As they packed the robot away for the last time and lifted ship, they saw no sign of the presence. But Lindsay had no doubt that it was with them. He was tired as they ascended slowly toward the surface. More than his shaper favorite or the armored mechanist, he felt the burden of his hubris heavy on him. Who was he to have done these things? The light had drawn him, and he had grown toward it as a tree might grow, spreading blind leaves toward an unknown radiance. Now he had come to his life's fruition, and he was glad of it. But a tree dies when its roots are cut, and Lindsay knew his roots were his humanity. He was a thing of flesh and blood, of life and death, not an immanent will. A tree drew strength from light, but it was not light itself. And life was a process of changing, but it was not change itself. That was what death was for. When they saw sunlight flooding just below the surface, Pilot yowled in electronic glee and kicked in the main engines. Steam blasted out in an explosive cratering rosette as the sea recoiled. They broke Mach 1 in seconds. As acceleration crushed them into their seats, Vera strained to see her video board and screamed,
"The sky! Blue sky! A wall above the world! Pilot, give us space!"
Below them, the sea absorbed the shock, as it did all things, and they were gone. The Neotenic Cultural Republic, 8886. Life moved in clades. Terraform Cluster loomed over Mars, shattering red monotony with white steam, green growth, blue nascent seas. On Venus, Death's back was broken as honest clouds threw lace across the searing, acid-bitten sky.
Ice ships with freshly minted creatures from the labs splashed into Europa, dissolving deep within blood-warm abysses. On Jupiter, the great red spot was breaking up, sloughing off strange blooming clouds of red krill, tiny creatures gathered in shoals and herds bigger than Earth. At the Neotenic Cultural Republic, Abelard Lindsay decamped from a monstrous spacecraft. In the freefall zone, he moved easily, with the unconscious grace of extreme age. But as he moved down the slope inside the cylindrical world, past the hotels and low-grav tourist shops, he leaned more and more heavily on the squat head of his robot companion. The two of them reached level ground, a loamy wilderness with solemn, ancient ranks of trees. The tub-shaped robot nurse nicked a quick blood sample from the nerveless flesh of Lindsay's leg. As they shuffled along the leaf-strewn footpath, the machine fractionated the blood and mumbled over its data. The Republic had become a place of towering gloom, silence broken by bird calls, a canopy of foliage cracking mirrored sunlight into dappled shards. Local neotenics in studiedly antique clothing lounged on lichen-eaten stone benches, while their charges, senile shapers and obsolescent mechs, tottered marveling through the woods. Lindsay paused, gasping as the cuirass pumped his chest beneath his dark blue coat. The baggy legs of his trousers and his sturdy orthopedic shoes hid the prosthetic framework strapped to his wasted legs. Overhead, at the core of the world, an ultralight aircraft spewed a long trail of gray, cremated powder over the rich green treetops. No one approached him. The embroidered squids and anglerfish on his coat sleeves identified him as a Circum-European, but he had come incognito. Catching his breath, Lindsay walked on toward the Tyler mansion and his meeting with Constantine. The mansion had expanded. Beyond its ivy-shrouded walls, other estates had sprung up, a complex of asylums and retirement wards. Over the years, despite the preservationists, the outside world had seeped in irresistibly. The Republic's premier industries were hospitals and funerals, rehabilitation for those who could make it, a quiet transition for those who could not. Lindsay crossed the courtyard of the first hospital. A group of blood bathers basked in the sun, waiting with animal patience for their skins to grow again. Beyond that estate was a second, where two young patternists were surrounded by guards. They scratched at the dirt with twigs, their lopsided heads almost touching. Lindsay saw one of them look up for a moment. The boy's cold eyes had the chilly logic of utter paranoia. Neatly dressed Neotenic attendants ushered Lindsay through the gates of the Tyler estate. Margaret Giuliano had been dead for years. Lindsay recognized the new director as one of her Superbright students. The Superbright met him on the lawn. The man's face had the quiet self-possession of Zen serotonin.
"I've cleared your visit with Warden Pongpian School," he said.
"That was thoughtful," Lindsay said.
Neville Pongpian School was dead, but it was not polite to refer to the fact. Following Ring Council ritual, Pongpian School had faded, leaving behind him a programmed web of speeches, announcements, taped appearances, and random telephone calls. The Neotenics had never bothered to replace him as warden. It saved a lot of trouble all around.
"May I show you through the museum, sir?" the Superbright asked. "Our last curator, Alexandrina Tyler, left an unmatched collection of Lindsayana."
"Later, perhaps. Is Chancellor General Constantine receiving visitors?"
Constantine was in the Rose Garden, lying in a lounge chair beside a beehive, staring up into the sun with flat plastic eyes. The years had not been kind to him, despite the best of care. Long years in natural gravity had left his body knotted with muscle, strange knobs and bulges over his delicate bones. There was no ultraviolet in the mirrored sunlight of the Republic, but nevertheless Constantine had tanned, his ancient naked skin taking on mottled birthmark tinges of purple and blue. He had lost most of his hair, and there were dimpled callosities at strategic points on his skull. The treatments had been thorough and exhaustive, and at last they had succeeded. Constantine turned as Lindsay creaked carefully toward him. The pupils of his plastic eyes were of different sizes. They irised visibly, struggling for focus.
Abelard, it's you?
Yes, Philip.
The robot sank down beside the lounge chair. Lindsay sat comfortably on its soft, pulpy head.
So, how was your trip?
It's an old ship, Lindsay said. A bit like a flying geriatrics ward. They were having a revival of Vetterling's The White Periapsis.
Not his best work.
You always had good taste, Philip.
Constantine sat up in his chair.
Should I call for a robe? I've looked better, I know.
Lindsay spread his hands.
If you could see beneath this suit, I haven't wasted much money on rejuvenation lately. I'm going for total transformation when I return. It's Europa for me, Philip. The seas.
Sun dogging out from under human limitations?
Yes, you could say that. I've brought the plans with me.
Lindsay reached into his coat and produced a brochure.
I want you to look at them with me.
All right. To please you.
Constantine accepted the pamphlet. The center pages showed an angel's portrait, an aquatic post-human. The skin was smooth and black and slick. The legs and pelvic girdle were gone. The spine extended to long muscular flukes. Scarlet gills trailed from the neck. The ribcage was black openwork, gushing white, feathery nets packed with symbiotic bacteria. The long black arms were dotted with phosphorescent patches in red and blue and green, keyed into the nervous system. Along the ribs and flukes were two long lateral lines. The nerve-packed stripes housed a new aquatic sense that could feel the waters trembling, like touch at a distance. The nose led to lung-like sacs packed with chemosensitive cells. The lidless eyes were huge, and the skull had been rebuilt to accommodate them. Constantine moved the brochure before his eyes, struggling to focus.
Very elegant, he said at last. No intestines.
Yes, the white nets filter sulfur for bacteria. Each angel is self-sufficient, drawing life, warmth, everything from the water.
I see, Constantine said.
Community with anarchy.
Do they speak?
Lindsay leaned forward, pointing to the phosphorescent lights.
They glow.
Do they reproduce?
There are genetic labs, aquatic ones. Children can be created. But these creatures can last out centuries.
But where's the sin, Abelard? The lies, the jealousy, the struggle for power?
He smiled.
I suppose they can commit gauche acts of ecosystem design.
They don't lack ingenuity, Philip. I'm sure they can find crimes if they try hard enough. But they're not like we were. They're not forced to it.
Forced to it.
A bee landed on Constantine's face. He brushed it gently away. He said,
I went to see the impact site last month.
He meant the spot where Vera Kelland had crashed.
There are trees there that look as old as the world.
It's been a long time.
I don't know what I expected. Some kind of golden glow, perhaps. Some shimmer to show where my heart was buried. But we're small creatures, and the cosmos doesn't care. There was no sign of it.
He sighed.
I wanted to measure myself against the world, so I killed the thing that might have held me back.
We were different people then.
No, I thought I could make myself different. I thought that with you dead, you and Vera, I'd be a clean slate, a machine for pure ambition, a bullet fired into the head of history. I tried to seize power over love. I wanted everything bound in iron, and I tried to bind it. But the iron broke first.
I understand, Lindsay told him. I've also learned the power of plans. My life's ambition awaits me in Europa.
He took the brochure.
It could be yours, too, if you want it.
I told you in my message that I was ready for death, Constantine said.
You always want to sidestep things, Abelard. We go back a long way together. Too far for words like friend or enemy. I don't know what to call you, but I know you. I know you better than anyone. Better than you know yourself. When you face the consummation, you'll step aside. I know you will. You'll never see Europa.
Lindsay bowed his head.
It has to end, Abelard. I measured myself against the world. That was why I lived. And I cast a large shadow, didn't I?
Yes, Philip.
Lindsay's voice was choked.
Even when I hated you most, I was proud of you. But to measure myself against life and death as if I could go on forever, there's no dignity in that. What are we to life? We're only sparks.
Sparks that start a bonfire, maybe?
Yes, Europa is your bonfire, and I envy you that. But if you go to Europa, you will lose yourself in it, and you couldn't bear that.
But you could do it, Philip. It could be yours. Your people will be there, the Constantine clan.
My people, yes. You co-opted them.
I needed them.
I needed your genius. And they came to me willingly.
Yes, death defeats us in the end, but our children are our revenge against it.
He smiled.
I tried not to love them. I wanted them to be like me, all steel and edge. But I loved them anyway. Not because they were like me, but because they were different. And the one most different I loved the best.
Vera.
Yes, I created her from the samples I stole here, in the Republic. Flakes of skin, genetics from the ones I loved.
He looked at Lindsay pleadingly.
What can you tell me of her, Abelard? How is your daughter?
My daughter?
Yes, you and Vera were a splendid pair. It seemed a shame that death should make you barren. I loved Vera too. I wanted to guard her child and the child of the man she chose. So I created your daughter. Was I wrong to do it?
No, Lindsay said. Life is better.
I gave her everything I could. How is she?
Lindsay felt dizzy. Beneath him, the robot slid a needle into his unfeeling leg.
She's in the labs now. She's going through the transformation.
Ah, good. She makes her own choices, as we all must.
Constantine reached beneath his lounge chair.
I have poison here. The attendants gave it to me. They grant us the right to die.
Lindsay nodded in distraction as the drugs calmed his pounding heart.
Yes, he said. We all deserve that right. We could walk out to the impact site together, you and I, and drink the poison. There's enough for two.
Constantine smiled.
It would be good to have company. No, Philip, not yet. I'm sorry. Still no commitment, Abelard?
Constantine showed him a glass vial filled with brown liquid.
It's just as well. I have trouble walking. I have trouble with all dimensions since the arena. That's why they gave me new eyes. The eyes see dimensions for me.
He twisted the top from the vial with gnarled fingers.
I see life for what it is now. That's why I know I must do this.
He put the poison to his lips and drank it down.
Give me your hands.
Lindsay reached out. Constantine gripped his hands.
Both of them are metal now?
I'm sorry, Philip.
No matter. All our beautiful machines.
Constantine shuddered briefly.
Bear with me. This won't take long.
I'm here, Philip.
Abelard, I'm sorry. For Nora.
for the cruelty.
Philip, it doesn't. I forgive.
It was too late. The man had died. Circum Europa, 25-12-86. What was left of life in Circum Europa was clustered in the labs. When Lindsay disembarked, he found customs deserted. Circum Europa was through. Imports no longer mattered. He followed a snaking hallway through translucent, tilted walls of membrane. The corridors glimmered, painted with all the blue-green tints of seawater. They were almost deserted. Lindsay glimpsed occasional sundogs and squatters, come for junk and loot. A party of them waved politely as they sawed noisily through a hard-set wall. An investor ship had docked as well, but there was no sign of its crew. The movement was all outwards. Giant ice ships, hulled in crystal, were arcing down to the planet's surface for gentle splashdowns through the new crevices. Vera, his daughter, was aboard one of them. She had already gone. The population had shrunk to a final handful, the last for the transformation. Circum Europa had dwindled to a series of labs, where the last transformees floated in smoky European seawater. Lindsay paused outside an airlock, watching the activity within, through a hall-mounted monitor. Transformed surgeons were assisting at the births of angels, tracking the growth of new nerves through the altered flesh. Their glowing arms flickered rapidly in conversation. He had only to don an aqualung, step through the airlock into blood-warm water, and join the others. Vera had done it, so had Gomez and the rest. They would greet him joyfully. There would be no pain. It would be easy. The past hung balanced on the moment. He could not do it. He turned away. Then he sensed it.
"You're here," he said. "Show yourself."
The presence floated down from the tilted sea-green membrane of the wall. A puddle of mirrors trickled across the floor, seeping into shape. Lindsay watched it in wonder. The presence had its own gravity. It clung to the floor as if pulled there. It warped and rippled, taking form to please him. It became a small, fleet thing poised on four legs, crouching like an animal. Like a weasel, he thought. Like a fox.
"She's gone," Lindsay told it. "And you let her go."
"Relax, citizen," the fox told him. Its voice had no echo. It made no sound. "It's not my business to hold on to things."
"Europa's not to your taste?"
"Oh, hell," it said. "I'm sure it's fabulous there. But I've seen the real thing, remember? On Earth. What about you, sundog? I don't see you going for it."
"I'm old," Lindsay said. "They're young. It should be their world. They don't need me."
The creature stretched, rippling.
"I thought you'd say as much. What do you say, then, now that you have a chance for a reflection?"
Lindsay smiled, seeing his own warped face across the shining film of the presence.
"I'm at loose ends."
"Oh, very good." There was laughter in the unheard voice. "I suppose you'll be dying now."
"Should I?"
He hesitated.
"It might be premature."
"It might," the presence agreed. "You'll stay here a few more centuries, then, and await the final transcendence?"
"The fifth pre-Gogenic level of complexity?"
"You could call it that. The words don't matter. It's as far beyond life as life is from inert matter. I've seen it happen many times before. I can feel it moving here. I can smell it in the wind. People, creatures, beings, they're all people to me. They ask the final questions, and they get the final answers. And then it's goodbye. It's the Godhead, or as close as makes no difference to the likes of you and me. Maybe that's what you want, sundog. The absolute?"
"The absolute," Lindsay mused. "The final answers. What are your answers, then, friend?"
"My answers? I don't have them. I don't care what goes on beneath this skin. I want only to see, only to feel. Origins and destinies, predictions and memories, lives and deaths.
I sidestep those. I'm too slick for time to grip. You get me, Sundog?
What do you want then, Presence?
I want what I already have. Eternal wonder. Eternally fulfilled. Not the eternal, even, just the indefinite. That's where all beauty is. I'll wait out the heat death of the universe to see what happens next. And in the meantime, isn't it something? All of it?
Yes, Lindsay said.
His heart was hammering in his chest. His robot nurse reached for him with a needle load of soothing chemicals. He turned it off, then laughed and stretched.
It's all very much something.
I had a fine time here, the Presence said. It's quite a place you have here, around this little sun.
Thank you.
Hey, the thanks are all yours, citizen. But there are other places waiting. The Presence hesitated.
You want to come along?
Yes.
Then hold me.
He stretched his arms out toward it. It came over him in a silver wave, stellar cold, a melting, a release. And all things were fresh and new. He saw his clothes floating within the hall. His arms drifted out of the sleeves, prosthetics trailing leashes of expensive circuitry. Atop its clean white ladder of vertebrae, his empty skull sank grinning into the collar of his coat. An investor appeared at the end of the hall, bounding along in freefall. Reflexively, Lindsay smeared himself out of sight against the wall. The investor's frill lifted. It pawed with magpie attraction through the tangle of bones, stuffing items of interest into a swollen bag.
They're always around to pick up the pieces, the Presence commented. They're useful to us. You'll see.
Lindsay perceived his new self.
I don't have any hands, he said.
You won't need 'em, the Presence laughed.
Come on, we'll follow him. They'll be going someplace soon.
They trailed the investor down the hall.
Where? Lindsay said.
It doesn't matter. Somewhere wonderful.